Actually, it's a pretty weak.
This is a test. One, two, three.
Missing everybody.
Senators Pullman.
Here.
Kilzer.
Here.
Sinner.
Here.
And Representatives Kaiser.
Here.
Ammerman.
Here.
And Ruby.
Here.
Wonderful. We do have a quorum.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, everyone. And before we even get started, I just want to thank Jennifer Clark out of Legislative Council for putting our agenda together, and Mr. Krista for providing us with information in advance and the links on the agenda so we can review all of that in advance. It's really helpful. I think I can speak for the whole committee when I say it's really helpful when we can help us digest that information even before the hearing. So thank you for that. And with that, we will move right into our business with a review of the supplementary rules of operation and procedure of the North Dakota Legislative Management. You have that listed there.
Okay. Madam Chairman, committee members, by this point in the interim, you've probably seen this at least once, which makes my job really easy. Do you need a copy?
Yes, I don't have a copy.
Well, let me take care of you. Do you have an extra packet over there?
Just jump right up and go for it.
Probably the high points that I want to hit on here are, although we are a statutory committee, in our the statute that creates this, it does say that we're going to follow the rules and procedure that are established by the legislative management. So we do follow these. It hasn't been an issue in the past, but a reminder that if you ever set up a subcommittee, you need to treat it just as if it were a full committee, which means you need to notice it needs to be public. You need to keep records, you need to keep minutes, everything. One thing to point out is with a relatively small committee with just six, I will take extra steps to make sure you're notified of meetings and we set meeting dates, because it's so important to have every one of you here when we, you know, especially when we've got that small committee. Like every other committee, if something should come up and the chairman decides she wants to offer the committee remotely through some electronic means, because I've pushed you all so much to make sure you can show up, if you make that request that you participate telephonically, we're going to make sure that it's reviewed by the chairman and that she opens that up for every participant on the committee. If it's available for one person, it has to be available for everyone who sits up here. But that's really, you know, other than that, you know the rules, you've seen them. I keep one of these in the front folder of my book up here, so if we need to we need to consult with them during the interim, we sure can. Are there any questions I can answer? Great, thank you.
And next on our agenda, presentation by Legislative Council staff of Workers' Compensation Review Committee Background Memorandum.
All right, thank you, Madam Chairman. So this is the only background memo we've got for this committee. I hope, were there copies up front when you came in? Great. You know how to read. I'm not going to read it for you. I know some of the faces are familiar here that you've sat through this process before. But what I would like to go through is essentially what our committee charges are. Like I'd mentioned, going over the supplementary rules, this is a statutory committee. You'll see in Appendix A, we've got a copy of the statute that creates the committee. And I'm going to keep this background memo in the front of my folder also, because if we ever talk about what are the authorities, what are the powers, what are the duties of this committee, typically I'm going to go back to this background memo because we've laid it all out here. The committee was created under 5435.22, and then as we've acquired additional duties, additional statutory duties, they've been put in some other sections of code. They're also included in here, so you have a reference for what our charges are as far as our statutory charges. If you look at, I'm going to hop over to Appendix A and walk through it a little bit. You notice it's got our statutory makeup. We've got our six members. We reference that we follow the legislative management rules. As an aside, how we've interpreted that is there's a provision here saying we need to meet quarterly if there's somebody who has a claim they want to review. We've interpreted that as, we're gonna meet during the interim, we're gonna suspend our activities during our session, so as we wrap up and do our final reports in the fall, next fall, then we're suspended until we start up again the next interim. So that's how we've interpreted it up till now, we haven't had any problems with that. We look at our powers here, and specifically our powers and our duties. Our duties are that we need to meet quarterly if there's a claim to review, we need to review those claims. And then as we review those claims, we need to accept the testimony of the injured worker. If that injured worker has a representative they've identified, it could be an attorney, it could be a spouse, it could be a child, it could be a neighbor. Somebody who we would invite to come up with them to help present their, or to just be moral support as they present their issues. And then we also need to request the WSI come in and have an opportunity to discuss the issues that are raised. As far as our powers go, what are we authorized to do? Well, you've got really broad discretion here. It says where you may recommend legislation relating to workers' compensation. As long as you stay in the realm of workers' compensation, you guys can recommend legislation out of this committee. Typically, that legislation has been limited to the claims that you've reviewed, kind of the hot topics you've received educational information on, the performance evaluation. You know, that's typically how it comes in here. But your statutory directive says you may recommend legislation relating to workers' compensation. So you've got that. As we talk about, you know, I've just kind of skirted around that you're going to receive claims from injured workers. We go in here and we say in order to be a qualified injured worker to have their claim presented before this committee, they've got to step through some specified steps here. First, they've got to be an injured worker. They've got to have submitted a claim. I guess when I say they have to be an injured worker, they have to have submitted a claim as an injured worker. They may have been determined not to be an injured worker, but they had to have submitted that claim. They have to have touched the agency. Or they've got to be the survivor of somebody who is an injured worker and is no longer living. And we've had that claimant come on before. So once you've identified that person who's had a touch with WSI, then we look and we say, well, WSI has to have issued a final determination. So it can't be something that's still in play. It falls into a situation that WSI is not completed working through. And then not only does there have to be a final determination, but the appeal process either needs to be exhausted or the time for appeal has to have expired. We're not going to require that somebody appeal this all the way up to the Supreme Court. You know, that would be, is it exhausted? We just have to make sure that their opportunity for appeal doesn't exist anymore. Again, we're not inserting the committee into the activities of an active case started. Over the years, you've put additional references in the code. So then that's what the next three references are, those first three bullets. Statutorily, WSI has a performance evaluation that's conducted every 4 years. On the years when we need to have the state auditor put together an RFP and contract out for that performance evaluation, at the beginning of our interim, we then have this committee select for the items to be included, then the state auditor selects four items. This interim's not one of those interims. We won't do that again until next. So we're on our off year right now for the performance evaluation. However, one of our requirements is that we receive information regarding actions taken under the performance evaluation. We can continue to receive status reports on that 2014 performance evaluation. I'd mentioned to the chairman that over the course of the meeting today, I can shoot out an email with a link to the 2014 performance evaluation so you can see it. It's a rather bulky document, so you probably don't want a paper copy of it, but I'll shoot you out an email. Then if they have any requests, if you want paper provisions of that, maybe you just want recommendations on one of the studies, I'd be happy to make copies of those for you. And then the other statutory charge that we have is that WSI's rehabilitation pilot programs will be reported on in this committee at least annually. So that's something that will come before us. In addition to those statutory references, we've got a couple provisions where WSI's got charges and it needs to be assigned to a committee. The legislative management has assigned those items to this committee, so we've got those three items, and now I'm on that second block of three bullets. We've got a biennial report on their safety grants. so that's something that we will be receiving at a future meeting. And then we've got, as part of WSI's biennial safety review of Rough Rider Industries and performance review of their modified workers' comp coverage, if they've got recommendations coming out of those, we'll receive those as well. Traditionally, we get those at the end of the interim, I think, maybe July 2016, but we can confirm that with WSI when they expect that will be ready. And that's a relatively short report. The other item that is specific to this interim, and I'm on that, the last of those bullets, is a report from WSI on whether there's been any industry interest in using their safety programs to provide server training for establishments that serve alcohol. And that's Appendix D, which is, it's hard to put in context. You'll see that we've got a report that's going to come in. We'll hear from WSI and what the status of that is and if there's been any interest or what they think it looks like. I can also shoot you an email that's got that entire bill on it so you can see why was this even brought forward, what was the interest. But there's an interest to improve server training for alcohol establishments, and this is a piece of it. So that's our background on the study charges themselves. Then we've got our basic background for WSI, for workers' compensation in the state. You know, like most things, we address it in the statute and in administrative rules. It's also constitutionally created, so I've given you the citations on that. And then there's that table at the very end where you can kind of see in a nutshell an overview of what this committee's done. You can see since its creation, the 2005-06 interim to this last interim, how many claims have they reviewed and how many bill drafts have been recommended out of the committee. I think you'll see there's a little trend as far as how many claims have come before the committee. So that's something to keep in mind. And then as I flip over to page 2, this is that review process, that claims review process. I want to put this on hold until our 2:15 agenda item. So we'll pick up this background memo again at the back end of our meeting. And then I'm going to flip over to the very last page of the background memorandum. And I'm really just repeating what I said in our study charges is BIA would have laid out here. We've got our claims process, and that's at the end of the day when you leave here. That's what I'd really like to have is an approved claim process so we can get that out then. We can start moving and see if we've got interested claimants. We can get a timeline on the reports, so find out from WSI when is it reasonable to expect you'll have this in, when should we make sure we have a meeting schedule evaluation. It's always nice because remember our duties, our powers say you can introduce anything you want on WSI. Not bad to find out what is on those, what kind of fatalities have we experienced, what's the data on that. Or is there anything specific going on with the oil industry? Has it changed the way you do business? What's your data like on that? If there's a hot topic that you guys want to use this as an opportunity to learn about, you can certainly bring that to the chairman's attention and see if that's something you can schedule in here. So that's my spin on, you know, what approach you might take.
Senator Kielzer?
Madam Chairman and Jennifer, this is kind of a specific and a general question. On Appendix A, would it be a conflict of interest or a conflict in any way for somebody to be a legislator to be sitting on this committee and also sitting on the Fiscal Review and Audit Committee? And that's kind of the specific question. And then the general question is there ever a situation that if a legislator sits on one interim committee, he or she shouldn't be sitting on another specific interim committee?
Madam Chairman, Senator Kielzer, you kind of caught me off guard there. That's a good question. I haven't thought about it. I suppose it'd be interesting because does Lafferty receive the performance evaluation that's conducted for WSI? Because that's typically where it would come in, right? Do you know?
I think they receive a financial audit. I'm not sure about the performance.
I mean, as you look at possible conflicts, that's probably one of the places where it would come up. But I think that performance evaluation is not, you know, I think we're very careful to say it's not an audit. It's an evaluation. So it comes to this committee. Are you, I can do some research if you'd like, you know, and go upstairs and visit with some people about, are there other dual hats that you wear?
Well, Madam Chairman and Jennifer, it certainly does happen, and I don't have any specific cases in mind or anything. I'm just wondering, and I think we can proceed, but I'd like to hear a response to it sometime in the future.
Are there other questions for Jennifer regarding her background? Okay, let's move forward then. We have Mr. Brian Kipsow here. He is the Executive Director and CEO of Workforce Safety and Insurance, and he is going to be talking about the implementation of that performance evaluation and an overview of WSI trends. Thanks for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am going to talk this afternoon a little bit about our performance evaluation. I did talk to the committee a while back, last fall when we got our final report, so probably won't be a lot of different information. The performance evaluation was committed by Sedgwick Claims Management Services. And we presented this initially to the committee on September 8th. If you remember, at one time, we used to have these performance evaluations every 2 years. So I'd really like to thank the Legislative Assembly for making sure it's every 4 years, or making this law change in 4 years, because it really was really taxing on our staff to make sure we get all the data and stuff put together. So appreciate that. The Sedgwick Claims Management, there were 8 elements picked. With 4 was the State Auditor's Office and 4 was the committee. The elements were IMEs, fraud, certain aspects of claim processing, vocational rehabilitation, designated medical provider program, narcotic utilization, cost of living adjustments, and PTSD. The majority of the claims, some of the positives, I think, and there were some recommendations for improvement. There are like 40 recommendations that we can make improvement. But some of the positives that we took out of this performance evaluation, one of the areas that we often criticize, I guess, is in the IME, independent medical examiner. And so this was one of the elements that they picked. And basically, we don't use probably as many IMEs as other workers' comp jurisdictions do, so that was, I think, a positive. Majority of the claims, we make good use of the IMEs to assist with other issues that are unsolved. WSI made well-documented attempts to provide the IME appointment date, time with reasonable time frame. And so I think our process dealing with the IMEs is a good process. One of the things that we are working on is to find some IMEs in the state of North Dakota. I know the last legislative session that was one of the issues, and we are working with a vendor to try to find some IMEs for the state of North Dakota. So that is in the process. A couple other things, when you look at, let me skip over the next one, the claims processing parts or claim processes. In the past, in our past performance evaluation, that has been an area where they really look carefully, and seems to be something coming out of it, such as you're denying too many claims, or you're accepting too many claims, or there's always, you can't make anybody very happy with the results of that. But on this last one, when they looked at the claim process, we had basically 3 recommendations, and 3 of them were fairly minor. So to me, that's an indication that I think we're constantly improving and we're trying to be better all the time in handling our claims processing. And so that was a positive. We got credit for Sedgwick recommending we bring vocational rehab back in-house services, which we did a couple sessions ago, and that's been a real good process, good move. We picked up some real good employees. I know some of our employees worked for Corvell, which when it was outside of our agency, And I talked to one of the execs at Corvella, they're not really happy that we stole a lot of their good employees, but a lot of good employees came working for us, so that's a positive. Our preferred worker program, I guess that's good frequent communications. And you know, a couple other things, we did also have the narcotic utilization, cost of living adjustments and PTSD. DMPs, again, that's something we've been, designated medical providers, something we've been working on, try to see if we can make that program better. And I know there's been some challenges with that. The vocational rehabilitation program, I think we have a great in-house program. The director, Robin Halverson, will be talking a little bit about some of the pilot programs we have there. Narcotic utilization, we finally got a bill through now for opioid usage. That was really big. That took a couple sessions, but finally got that through. And I think that's been very positive. We have very generous cost of living adjustments for our injured workers who are collecting indemnity. This is based on the cost of the increase in the wages in the state, so that's really been good the last few years, another positive for our injured workers. And then the last thing was the PTSD, and that bill was, I guess, brought before the legislature and was defeated. So and we got some good positive things happened in the last legislative session. Really appreciate the things that went on, and you know, continue to look forward to working with you. I guess the other thing with the performance evaluation, I guess that's probably the main thing you want to hear me talk about anyway, is the fact that we did have 40 recommendations. Seven of those 40 we were had in progress already that we were working on prior to the performance evaluation. And so we concurred with 29 of those recommendations, partially concurred with 5, and did not concur with 6 recommendations. And as of August 2015, WSI has closed out 26 recommendations and 14 are still in progress. So we're still working on them. So that's why it takes time. So it's nice to have these every 4 years so we have some time to work on them. So that's a little quick overview of our the performance evaluation. And normally we present this performance evaluation to work comp review committee. So that's next time we have one, we will bring it back to you again. The state auditor's office is the one that selects the vendor, so that's a whole other story again that we'll talk about that later. So any questions on the performance evaluation?
I just have one question. When we talk about some of the recommendations and you think to what you are working on currently, what would you say you're working on the most, or that's taking the most time and effort to improve upon as workforce safety?
You know, fortunately, we have a really good internal audit staff, and so they don't only always just deal with the performance evaluation. They're looking at other parts of our business and things we can make improvements on. But you know, I think some of the areas that the areas that we probably have more work in is dealing with claims, and those would be like the IMEs, you know, different doctors' opinions, dealing with claims, pre-existing conditions, I mean, are difficult. So there's just a lot of, those areas are something that we struggle with all the time. You look at the workforce in North Dakota, you know, we're fortunate to say we're getting younger, but some other places you have the older workforce, that's taking, you know, probably a little longer time to rehab and different things like that. So those the claims processing are challenges that we have to constantly work on. And they're the ones that they're our cost. That's what costs us the money. That's what the employers are paying for. So we're going to be very cognizant about those.
Senator Spinner.
Thank you, Chairman. Brian, in the report of those 40 recommendations, 29 of them were listed as high priority. How many of those 29 have been of those high priority? How many of those have been dealt with? Rather than the medium were 8 and the low priority were 3.
Well, I guess I don't have that information unless somebody else does. But basically, we've We've closed out 26 out of the 40, and we have 14 left to work on. So
close meaning that you either have you've implemented the changes,
or we did not concur with them, either one of the two. So
okay, and can you outline how many you did not concur with of the 29, or you probably don't know that?
I don't have that off the top of my head, but I'd like to say in our final report we have we concurred with 29 of the recommendations, partially concurred with 5, and did not concur with 6 of the recommendations. That's the overall total out of the overall 40 that we had. So I don't know what your question is, if we which ones we didn't concur with.
Well, of the 29 that were listed as high priority, how many of those have you gone along with the recommendations of those 29? How many have you gone along with those changes or those recommendations and made those changes? And how many have you do not concurred, or even if you did concur and haven't made the changes yet?
I guess I don't have that detailed report. I don't know, do we have anybody here in the room that have anything that detailed? Okay, we can get that detail for you.
Thank you. And will you list the ones that you've concurred with? And I know they're in the report, they say you concur, but it doesn't tell us where where we are today. Right? Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You can correct me, or maybe I can say this, it really is not with the performance audit, but I think it's a question for the director as long as he's up here. I looked through the agenda, but I'd like a little information from WSI because my wife got a letter. There was a security breach in the software or in the computer system. She got a letter that personal information from claimants might be in jeopardy, that type of thing. Can you just a quick overview of how that occurred and what's been done, and was there anybody's information kind of stolen?
Madam Chair, I can do that. I'll tell you what, let me go through the trends here of the PowerPoint I have, and then I'll cover that at the end of my presentation as far as what happened and kind of what we did.
Thank you.
Okay?
Representative Tiger.
Madam Chair and Brian, before you leave the performance review, do you have any idea how many states require a performance review of their workers' comp programs?
Chair, Representative Kaiser, I don't know. I might have to, we can check it out or check for sure. I don't know. Okay.
Okay, continue. Okay.
We'll get that information to you. Okay, just a quick few minutes here on our WSI trends. And I'll start out with the employer accounts. And if you take a look at your first PowerPoint presentation we have. It shows the active employer counts over the last fiscal year 2016, fiscal year 2015. And, you know, fiscal year 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, fiscal year 2010, we were hanging pretty much at 20,000 employers. That was kind of our limit. We hit a couple thousand new ones in every year, and a couple of thousand were canceled. So we kept it to 20,000. So that's been our number for a number of years. So you start looking at fiscal year 2011, you start seeing an increase, a really big increase, fiscal year 13, 14, and then fiscal year 15, which ended this last June, we still continue to have more, quite a few employers in there. Now, I'm not sure there will be a correction later on. Looks like our claim numbers are coming down a little bit, but we'll see how they impact this in the future. The next slide, and I think this is one that is very, I think, is interesting. If you take a look at the red line, and you see those are the new employer accounts that come in the state. And you look at the yellow line, those are the employer accounts that can cancel out. So you look back, in 08, 09, 9 and 10, you see that it's pretty close as far as the number of new accounts and the number of ones canceled, so we kept pretty level. But then as you get to 11, 12, and 12, 13, 11, 12, we had 4,400 new accounts, and we had 1,600 cancellations. So that's where the growth was going. But if you follow that line all the way to the 14th, 15th IM, you'll see that we had 3,100 new accounts, and we had 2,500 cancellations. So you see the numbers coming this close again, which is probably an indicator of what's happening out in the state of North Dakota, predominantly in the oil field. The next slide, third slide, is on WSI earned premium and covered workforce. And so, you know, 2009-10, our earned premium was $173 million. Fast forward to 2014-15, our earned premium is $361 million. That's over a double increase in our earned premium that we collected from employers, which means there's more employees in the state and the wages are better. And also, the other interesting thing is you look at the covered workforce went from 340,000 to 435,000, so tremendous increase in the covered workforce. And so that's just, and then you look at the next slide after that, then you can see that the increases and what industry has increased. You look at the 07-08, 69.8% of our premium, 70% of our premium was collected by other. And the other three, construction, petroleum, and trucking, those are our hazardous ones. The percentage was 40% of our business or 30% of our business was covered in those three areas. And then you fast forward to 2014-15, and close to 50% in other and about 50% in the other, the construction, petroleum, and the trucking. So those three industries, and when you look at them over as a whole, are our most hazardous. And so we've had tremendous increase in those areas. So, don't like to look at it that way, but the natural tendency would be then to have more severe injuries and deaths because of the more hazardous type work. So that's been an increase from 2009-10, and we were talking about percentages here, but we had our premium collected, earned premium for construction, petroleum, and trucking was about $55 million. And for the construction, petroleum, and trucking, the premium that we collected in 2014-15 was about $180 million. So, like I say, tremendous increase in the premium collected and the number of employers in that area. Okay, the next slide is I'm talking about the claims, and here you can see that when you 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, we're basically about 20,000 claims. So our business has always been 20,000 employers, 20,000 filed claims. And so you get to fiscal year 11, and then fiscal year 14, it topped out at 26,395 filed claims. Fiscal year 15, which ended June 30th, we had 24,798. So the claims are coming down a little bit, and I hope that tendency will continue. Next slide is, not only have our FOG claims going up, the other thing that we've been dealing with a lot is the out-of-state injury workers. So they come to North Dakota to work, and then they go back to their home state to treat, and it gets really difficult to manage that care. When you're dealing with out-of-state doctors and nurses and fee schedules and things like that. So when you look at the tremendous increase in our out-of-state claims, and those are coming down a little bit too, but getting up to 6,000 out of the 26,000 claims in fiscal year 14 were from out-of-state. So that gives us another unique challenge. And we've done a very good job taking care of that. Some other slides that might be of interest, you look at the medical-only claims, the average severity, and that's going up, continues to, with medical inflation and all sorts of other things that are going on. But for a claim with medical-only, the average cost is $1,600. And if you go over to the lost time claims, you'll see that the average claim, lost time claims, so those are usually the more severely injured ones, those costs have gone up dramatically. And so the lost time claim, the average cost is, average severity is $99,000, $100,000. So it's really expensive. Anytime you have time loss claims, And that's why we do everything we can to, first of all, make sure the workplace is safely, you know, there's safety out there, make sure we don't have the injuries. And then if there is injury, we want to make sure that the injured worker files right away and get on top of that claim right away so it doesn't drag out.
Understood.
Thank you, Chairman. Brian, you talked about those lost time claims. What's the average amount of time lost that's paid for in there?
Not sure, Senator. I don't know. I'll check if somebody else here knows. No. Average time off. We'll get that for you. Okay. Good question. Is it stump Brian today or what? Okay. And then the last slide I have is accepted fatalities by cause of injury. And the main reason I put that one in there is because it shows that when you look at our fatals out there, you're looking at about 50% of our workplace fatalities are traffic. And so there's an article in the Bismarck paper here a couple of days ago where they talked about the increase in fatalities this year on our roadways. And so that impacts us directly. Because that's where a lot of our fatalities are happening. So we try to monitor that, and hopefully with the infrastructure changes they've made and the more law enforcement stuff like that, we can get those numbers down a little bit also.
Representative Kaiser.
Madam Chair, Brian, on that last graph, I was really interested in that one, but your numbers are wrong.
Okay.
Those percentages just don't add up. So. Could you just have somebody
accepted fatality ones or
yeah.
Okay.
I mean the 32 and 8 and 4 and 2 and 8 and 4 don't make 100. It's a long ways off. Now maybe fatalities are 62.56.
Well, I think what they have is this is okay, accepted fatalities by cause. Okay, so we had I think these are the file claims. Really. So if we look at the numbers, it would be different. The number of file claims is different than our accepted claims. Because people will file a death claim, and then that individual will, maybe we don't cover that company or whatever, so then we don't accept those. So that's the only thing I can think about here. That's probably the difference. So thank you.
Just check it.
Yeah. We'll get it. We'll get it after anyway. Just to see Representative Kaiser is like the expert in workers' comp after that presentation he had out in Montana and all that information he had. So a lot of good things going on. The last thing I want to talk a little bit about is the staffing. And Representative Kaiser probably doesn't remember this, but a few sessions ago when a number of employers were going up, premium was going up, we had more fog claims, and we went to through the legislative session, we got three additional employees, and we needed a lot more employees to get the job done. So, Representative Kaiser kindly told me, said, it's your job to figure it out. So that's what we tried to do. But we've really done some really good things, innovative programs where we have this last session now, we got 10, so we're up to 260 employees. And then we also have about 35 temporary employees. And the part that we did that we thought was interesting, and probably a lot of state agencies don't do it that way, is our temp employees, we need them to get our business accomplished. We have to have them. So we will give them their hourly wage, we'll give them a little bit additional pay because we don't pay, they don't get vacation, sick leave, and they don't get retirement. Plus, we'll give them an additional amount because as a state employee, we get family health, and they don't get it. We're only provided in a single health plan, so we'll give them a little bit per hour extra there to try to cover some of that. And then we will provide a single health plan to the employee. And that has really helped retain some of our temp employees, and we haven't had the large turnover that we probably could have had. So that has worked very well for us, and we're going to continue with that. And then it's kind of showed a kind of side benefit, because not only do you have these temp employees, but then when you do have an FTE, like a claims adjuster FT, then do you have a trained person that can move into the FT position? So it's worked out very well for us. So we did come up with a way to make sure that we did get our business accomplished.
Question?
Senator Sinner.
Question, Brian, what's the average pay for those temps?
Madam Chair, Senator Sinner, I think if you look at, I'll use a claims adjuster because that's the one that we probably just hired, so.
But across the board? Across the board, I mean, up to top to bottom, what's kind of the average? Is it $15 an hour? Is it $30 an hour? Is it?
Well, I think with those enhanced benefits we give, and I'll give you a for a claims adjuster because that's probably the ones we have most temps in. We're looking at, with the additional pay, about $23.50 an hour.
Do you have temps in lower positions, lower paid positions in that? You do?
Yeah, we have some in office services and other places too. And I can, if you want more information, I can get that for you if you want more.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Clifford? Seeing none, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have moving on to our legislative review, Jody Bjornson, General Counsel for Workforce Safety and Insurance, is going to be giving us a review of the legislation surrounding workers' compensation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jody Bjornson, General Counsel for WSI, and I am happy to take you through the legislation from 2015 that passed that was significant to WSI. Within your packet are the actual bill drafts, and in front of each bill draft there's a little cheat sheet with a synopsis of each bill. And so, with your permission, Madam Chair, we can go through each bill. And I'll take you through each section, rather a high overview, okay? So I'm on the first bill, House Bill 1102, the next page after the first cheat sheet, okay? And the first section of that bill has to do with the definition of healthcare provider in workers' compensation law. And what this did was essentially update our definition of healthcare provider so that it included areas of medical expertise that WSI already as a matter of practice recognizes. So we're updating it really to conform to our practice of doing business right now. The next section, section two of that bill, deals with what we call the presumption clause in workers' compensation. And full-time paid firefighters and law enforcement officers are subject to a presumption that their claim is compensable. And there is a clause within that provision that in order for that provision to apply, the catchphrase is it has to result in total or partial disability or death. While we overstruck that language so that we can apply the presumption to all cases, irrespective if it was disability, medical only, death claims, and disability. We think that is in conformity with what the legislative intent called for. Section three then is a partial disability benefit provision. And this actually came from the 2014 performance evaluation. Our reviewer noticed an inequity in situations, in a small number of situations where partial disability benefits were received by an injured worker. Partial disability benefits plus the wages they earn sometimes exceeded this 90% cap that is in place for disability benefits. We don't pay disability benefits unless their loss of earnings capacity exceeds 10%. So for all other injured workers on total benefits, they were capped at 90%. And so this, per the recommendation of the performance eval, conformed partial disability benefits to the other type of disability. Moving on to section four. I'm at the bottom of the page, on page two. And this has to do with WSI scholarships. There again, we made a change so we had some consistency within the provision. We added a provision, as you see the guts of it, is subpart two. And what that essentially does is extend children of injured workers or death claim children so that they can have a scholarship opportunity beyond the ages of 18 through 22, which is our current definition. We've extended that to include children from 23 to 26 and made that consistent within the provision. You go on to subpart five on the top of page three of the actual bill. This one basically just permits us to share information with other state and federal entities. Basically, the two main examples I can give you, job service, and injured workers receiving job service benefits and WSI workers' comp benefits, inconsistent, share that information. And now we can do that with the statute. The other example is Medicare. Many times it's a big headache trying to get those who pays for what worked out, and we need to communicate with them. So that was the intent of section five. Moving on to section six, this proposed change basically eliminates the requirement of an administrative order when a vocational rehabilitation plan is in play. Like all other decisions that WSI makes, we issued this informal notice of decision, somewhat smaller and more compacted, prior to going to a formal order, which is a more legally wordy document. And what this does is allows us to issue that informal notice, and then if it's not appealed, we don't have to issue an order in all cases, which before we did. Even if it wasn't appealed, we'd go to an order. So they can still appeal the notice of decision and obtain a request for a formal legal order, but if they don't, we don't have to do the order under subpart six. If you look at subpart seven, this really alters our reporting to rehab pilot programs. We still maintain the ability to conduct rehab pilot programs, and you'll be hearing about a really, really exciting one today. But it eliminates a lot of the reporting requirements in the latter part of that section. Subpart eight, here again, educational loan fund. WSI has a loan fund for certain spouses and children and injured workers. And here again, there was some discrepancy in the application, inconsistency rather. And so we cleaned that up and made it clear that a child of an injured employee just has to meet the definition of child at the time of the initial loan application for all different types of benefit recipients under that provision. And then lastly, I'm on section nine on page five, and this change came, this was an average weekly wage of some of our volunteer first responders. And what it does is clarifies that the average weekly wage from a claimant's business or employment for these volunteers can only be included in that claimant's business when calculating their average weekly wage if they've got coverage for that business. And that makes it consistent with the statute that applies to all other injured workers similarly situated. And just for your information, page six is the voting record. We'll skip past that one and go on to House Bill 1103. Can I answer any questions?
Representative Kaiser.
Madam Chair, going back to section, Julie, four on the scholarship funds, We put this in there that scholarships may be awarded at the sole discretion of WSI. You didn't cover that. Is there any appeal process for a family?
If they apply for a scholarship and in the sole discretion of the agency, they say no? Can they go through the court?
Madam Chair and Representative Kaiser, my apologies. I missed that change. And no, they cannot. That's it. If you look at the last sentence, there's no right to reconsideration, rehearing, or appeal regarding the award, denial, or amount of a scholarship.
Representative Kaiser.
Thank you. Is that different than our other benefits? What other benefits can they not request the opportunity for appeal?
Off the top of my head, we do have that provision in the code elsewhere. There is no appeal in certain binding resolution dispute decisions for medical necessity. Continuing jurisdiction cannot be appealed. That means the ability to look at, to come back to us and to look at a claim if the appeal period has passed. We have discretion there. It exists. It exists. It's not frequent, but it is there.
Jody, what would be a time when someone would be rejected for a scholarship? What would eliminate your opportunity?
Madam Chair, and I'm so glad the experts that do this are here, but I do know there's a scholarship committee and certain criteria by administrative rule that they need to meet. And so my expectation would be that if those criteria were not met, then they wouldn't be entitled to the scholarship. But I would look to Robin to help.
is that accurate?
That's correct.
Okay. And can you think of anywhere we've denied them?
Madam Chair, community members, the education loan is administrated for us by the Bank of North Dakota. And so it follows all the criteria that the Bank of North Dakota requires for their student loans. And
okay.
So we follow what their recommendation is. We do have the ability to waive and accept the risk on that education loan, in which case then we need to have our executive director sign off on that waiver.
Okay. Thank you.
Scholarships
are internal?
Okay. Okay. If you'd like, Madam Chair, we can get more information on that for you.
That would be great. That would be lovely. Senator Sinner.
Yes, thank you. Jody, on Section 9 regarding the changes that were made to compensation benefits, and if I recall right, and I'm sure if I recall this part right, if a business owner is a volunteer firefighter or a farmer and they are injured, and because they're not under the system now, they are not allowed to have, or they will not be eligible for any compensation benefits. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sinner, right. The way the statute reads right now, in particular to farmers and now volunteers, is that if they have coverage for those wages that they're looking for us to replace, then we will cover. If not, we don't consider those wages. You're right.
Okay, so then to my real question regarding that is a change from previous law, correct?
Madam Chair and Senator, it is a clarification in the law. It is not a change from our interpretation of the law.
Okay.
And let me help you with that. We had an administrative law judge decision interpret it differently. Because the way 650603 reads, we didn't have the term average, the new term average in that provision. And in that particular case, the ALJ said, well, you must mean something different if average isn't in there. And our position was all along, no, we're treating everybody the same. If you don't have wages, coverage for those wages, we're not going to consider them. So that's from where it evolved. It is a change, but it isn't a change in our philosophy or practice.
So was there any notice to departments that have a lot of volunteer farmers and business owners that these people will not be covered with compensation benefits? Was there any notice to
Mr. Madam Chair and Senator Sinner, not to my knowledge, because I don't think there needed to be. This was kind of an anomaly of a situation. Our interpretation has been standard and consistent. Most people understand and are able to abide by that provision. So to the extent I don't have information, I'd look to Tim Orlean to further clarify that.
No, there was no notice that went out, because in our communications prior to this anomaly decision, we'd always told them, unless you're insured, those wages will not be insured. And so that's in conformity with the definition of average weekly wage.
But you and to just go around a little bit farther, if there's an injury, you do help them with the medical costs, do you not?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Medical.
Yep. Thank you.
Yep. Representative Ms. Kaiser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that issue, do all political subdivisions, including volunteer fire departments, et cetera, participate in a workers' comp plan and coverage?
I do not know. It is elective, and so I'm not sure.
But I think most of them do.
I would expect.
If they're reasonable.
Right. Yes.
And so this issue is really the maximum reimbursement based on the state average weekly wage is a function of your salary going into the injury. And so if you are someone, a professional, who has coverage and a very high salary, would get the maximum weekly wage replacement. But if the fire department doesn't have coverage, they don't get their employee coverage. Is that correct?
Well, no, I
think, or do they blend the two?
I think it is mandatory. It is mandatory. Yeah, I'm thinking of something else, but this is mandatory.
Yeah, I thought so.
The wages on which that they pay is what the premium is based on.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
So even if they participate, their volunteer organization isn't going to have significantly high wages. And if you average those, that person basically takes, in their mind, a hit. They're working as a fireman, but they'd like to be reimbursed as a professional.
I don't understand.
The way that we issue the workers' compensation coverage for those political subdivisions, since we don't have wages reported, it's issued on a per capita basis.
Right.
It's set a rate
by
the size of the community that's there. We never even take into account the possible wages of the volunteers working within the system.
Thanks, Tim.
Sorry.
No. Thank you, Tim. And in the future, if we could just get you up at the mic so we have it on record, that would be great.
Move over.
I don't know.
You
will.
Okay. Are you ready to move on?
I think we are.
The next bill? Okay. 1103. And this bill relates primarily to employer services. There's about three main provisions of the bill. And I'm on section one. This change basically was intended to allow us to have another tool to secure premium payments from employers. And really, it gives them, the employers, an instrument, kind of more options in paying their premium. So what we're looking at here are bonds, letters of credits, things of that nature to make sure that we get paid. The next section, section two, basically, this section increased for those uninsured employers. They increased the penalties for each non-compliance period. You can see from $2,000 to $5,000. Okay, and then it also cleared up different readings of the statute that we had internally on the latter part of that provision, and now it allows us to negotiate assessed penalties separately. Separate and aside from the claim costs and reserves that are assessed to that employer. And subpart four, the only change in that provision is going from $2,000 to $5,000 as well. And then lastly, section three, this was really a result of the work that's happening in our state and that in changing employment landscape that we're experiencing. And really, What it does is says you outside employer, if you hire employees in North Dakota to do work in this state, you need to have coverage. And in our extraterritorial law, it seemed that there were situations that were falling through the cracks where arguably the employer may not think that they need to have coverage. And that just has to do with where employers are coming from and where employees are coming from. Texas company hires a Louisiana employee to do work in North Dakota. We think that claim should be here in North Dakota, and that we should manage that claim, and that they should have coverage for it. So that was the reason for adding that provision. Moving along, the modified House Bill 1120. This wasn't our bill. This came from the Department of Corrections, but it did affect the WSI world and our title, so we did put that in there. And what it does really is requires the Rough Rider Industry Program, which you'll be hearing more reports about at later meetings, to be a part of that state entity's combined account for the Inmate Workers in Prison Industries Enhancement Program, the PIE program. And in that way, they are eliminated from having to secure excess coverage on their own. And because .WSI has reinsurance right now, they can just rely on WSI's reinsurance rather than to secure it on their own, which is, I understand, very unaffordable for them. And so change in structure to eliminate is something that wasn't achievable for that program. Moving on, the next bill we have is House Bill 1159. And that one was brought by your very own Representative Kaiser, and that's a very important bill. Really what it's intended to do is to ensure that WSI receives the information that it needs to adjudicate claims. And we were made aware of a disciplinary action by a physician involving a WSI claim where that physician provided information and was disciplined. As a result of that, provider community became a little bit worried about what could and could not be provided to WSI in the context of answering our questions. And so we did work with Sanford, we worked with the Board of Medical Examiners to help put together some language that made everybody comfortable and everybody knew what could be provided and what the consequences were, or lack thereof. And so that was a result of those efforts. On the bottom, there is really a safe haven. You do not incur liability for providing information to WSI, but only if you are what I would consider to be a naughty actor in providing that information. You have some sort of fraudulent intent in providing that information, then you might be subject to discipline, but not just providing it on its own. House Bill 1416, and Jennifer had alluded to this earlier. This is a bill relating to liability for injuries related to intoxication, and we were added at the end of that bill to really look at if there's interest in using our safety grant programs to look at an industry to help provide alcohol server training for employees of restaurants and bars. We are kicking off that process. I know there's a meeting in October with the Hospitality Association, so we can report more on that to you after that has taken place. And lastly, House Bill 2060. House Bill 2060 is the opioid bill. And there again, like Director Clipfoe had talked about, this was a result of the 2014 performance evaluation, and then remember it came from this committee. And ultimately, you can see the provisions in Section 1, one-page bill, but we looked at basically justifying and including documentation of greater function and pain relief to maintain opioid therapy. We looked at adding in random screenings and also looked for additional requirements that had to be maintained under subpart 2 in order to prescribe opioids to a patient. The remedy, if any of these provisions can't be met, is to discontinue paying for that therapy. So we will not shut the claim down. We'll continue with paying other benefits on the claim. It's just that particular medication. So that is the highlight of our bills this time around, Madam Chair. Any questions for Jody? Senator Sinnott?
One last question. Were there any bills that WSI supported that didn't get passed?
You know, the one that comes to mind is the PTSD bill. Can't remember if we were neutral or not on that bill, but I think that was the one.
Thank you. Moving on to reports, you'll see there on the agenda a list of reports that we will be receiving at some point during the interim. We just had Jody make reference certainly to the alcohol server training, so I think we'll hear more about that as time goes on. And we would move right along, I think, to our 2 p.m. agenda item, where we are going to be hearing about WSI's current rehabilitation services pilot program. And Robin is coming to speak to us about that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Halverson, and my role at WSI is I am the Return to Work Services Director. I oversee the vocational rehabilitation and the medical case management program. I also oversee the rehab pilot programs. Today I wanted to talk about our current rehab pilot program, which is based off of the collaborative divorce module that one of our legal counsel, Ann Scheibley, experienced in her practice in Minnesota under divorce law. What the process is when an individual is approaching into the divorce proceedings, they have the ability to purchase services that will assist them through the process. For example, an individual that has children may want to hire a child specialist, and they would help to ensure that the child's needs are considered when developing a new structure for parenting time. They may want to hire a communication coach. They may want to hire a financial planner. These professionals form a collaborative team, and this collaborative team assists them in helping them get through the divorce process and adjust to life as single parents or children of divorce. And so with Ann's expertise and our ability to initiate rehab pilot programs, we have put together a committee and we have formed what we call the Collaborative Vocational Support Program. And what this, our focus for the program is to provide the funding necessary for counseling and financial services at the onset of the vocational rehabilitation process. Counseling services will assist in the development and understanding of coping strategies that they can utilize throughout the vocational process. And financial services will educate and assist them with strategies and budgeting ideas they need to gain financial stability once again. What we have done in this program is we have contracted with two counselors. Now, these counselors are not psychiatrists, they're not psychologists, they are counselors, they do not diagnose and they do not treat. But what they do is work with individuals on coping strategies to help them with stress and to deal with some of the issues such as career changes that they have to go through when they come through the vocational process. We also have hired or contracted a firm of financial planners. And the financial planners will assist these individuals in identifying budgets, helping to assess the funding that they currently have with the funding they need to in order to maintain financial stability. What our program allows them to do is they are eligible for 6 visits with the counselors, and they are eligible for 4 visits with the financial planning. And what we hope that this will encourage them to embrace the vocational rehabilitation process and take advantage of the services that we can offer them. The sessions are confidential. WSI is not informed of any of the information that goes on in between the counselor or the financial planner, with the exception if there is the intent for harm for our agency or for the individual themselves. Through the pilot program, we do have the ability to reimburse mileage. Currently, our counselors are located in Fargo and Bismarck, and so we do have some individuals that want to take advantage of the program that do have to travel, so that we do make sure that we don't create a financial hardship for them to travel. Throughout the process, we continue to meet with the financial planners and the counselors to make sure that we are meeting the goals that we have set for our program. They offer us suggestions and changes that we may need to make to the program. Upon completion of the program, what we do then is our counselors and financial planners will contact us and let us know that they have completed the program, and we will send out questionnaires to these individuals and ask them for feedback. What could have we done differently? What can we do to make the program a little bit better program? Currently, we have offered the program to 58 individuals, and we have 11 that are currently participating in the program. And so we hope to get some feedback from them once they complete their program. And that's all I have. If you have some questions for me, I'd be more than happy to answer.
So you don't have any feedback yet from any of those who
have gotten any, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have not gotten any feedback on the questionnaires. Periodically, I have received telephone calls from individuals because they do have my contact number. And some of the suggestions that have come back to us is the time frame for putting them into the program, which is something that we're working on right now. Currently, it's at the onset of the vocational process. But I did have one gentleman that did indicate to me that he wished that he had had the program a little bit earlier. So our committee is working right now to try and tweak and see maybe when a better time is to allow them to participate in this program.
It's a difficult balance to strike to know when it's too early to offer the program when somebody's not in the right mindset or not looking that far down the road yet. It's a tough balance to find the perfect spot to offer that, I'm sure.
Madam Chair, yes, it is. It's the vocational process is quite emotional, and
yeah,
so
right. Representative Zomerman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Zomerman, you mentioned the two counselors are not psychiatrists or psychologists. What is their? Do they have degrees, or where do they? Or they are counselors. So where is their area's expertise that applies to this pilot program?
Madam Chair. Representative Armament, they are masters in counseling, and so they are considered mental health professionals, but they really focus a lot on strategies for overcoming loss, grief, stress, you know, significant changes in life.
Any other questions for Robin? I don't see any. Thank you. Are there any others who would like to speak about the pilot program? Anybody else who just has something to say today? Brian, thank you.
I'm going to clarify some of the stuff that I was stumped on before. Okay, for George, first of all, The numbers are right, so yeah. There are two years fatalities, and so one is the number, one is the percentage, so that was right. And then for Senator Center, we did get some information on the numbers, so we can, Tim will pull that up, and I can give those to you, the numbers as far as that you requested on the, for how many were high priority and how many of those were implemented.
Not sure what numbers you were talking about, because I asked about the average time on the, you know, on those losses, the average loss total of $100,000 on compensation.
We had that number too, but you had asked on the performance evaluation how many were high priority and how many we concurred with. Yep. So there were 29 that were high. We initially concurred with 22. Partially concurred with four and did not concur with three of those highs. And if you're interested, we have a sheet here with all the recommendations and if they're high priority or low priority and what our response was.
I've got a copy of the report.
Yeah.
Are you talking about the original report from Sedgwick? Didn't it list it in there?
Just a sheet that we put together that showed the recommendation, what our response was. It shows if it's high or medium or low and when it was implemented. So it's just some guidelines.
Okay. Well, we'd like to have that from the other members of the committee maybe too.
Fine, if all the committee members could get that, I think that would be really helpful. Thank you.
And then I can, if you want me to, I don't know if I really want to do it in front of the committee, but I can, Representative Ombrin on the cyber attack. Do you want that into the whole committee, or you just want Representative Ombrin to get that information?
I think sending it out to the whole committee would be great, if it's not too extensive.
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about it now, too, but unless you want to report on it, we can do that also.
Representative Ombrin, do you have a preference? Do you want to just hear about it now, or do you want a formal report from him later?
Well, if he thinks a report would be something we should have or something like that, I was just basically interested in how it came about, was anybody affected as far as claimants, you know, just a general overview of the situation as far as the cyber attack or whatever you want to call it.
Brian, would you be willing to just give us a quick overview?
Madam Chair, Representative Alderman, this was a cyber incident dealing with an ITD server. And it was an ITD server, because they keep track of all their information. It was an ITD server that had, it had like your website information on it, so probably not quite as secure as another server they have over there to have our information of our injured workers, the medical stuff and things like that. But anyway, this incident, they noticed some activity on this particular server in, I'm going to try to get the dates as accurate as I can, but end of May, like May 29th. So they noticed that there was something happening, that there was somebody trying to take information off that, so they shut down the information on the server right at that time. We were notified on June 10th, 10th, and as soon as we were notified that, hey, that there was somebody that got into this this server, we took a look at the information we had on it, and we had our website, but we had some information on there where people who filed incident reports on a claim, not a claim, but an incident report, that information on there with their name and the incident they reported and possibly Social Security number, personal identifying information was there. Plus there was from 2006 to 2013, all employers who filed online with their employees, they'd have their employee, their Social Security number, their ID number, their claim, and their salary, all that information was on that website. So when somebody tried to get through, and I guess I'm going to preface this by saying they don't think anything was taken from that website or that server. So no information they don't think was taken, but they're not sure. And somebody could have looked at some information, but they don't think it was downloaded. But so to be on the safe side, we took all the information that was on the server. We first of all took it off there because it shouldn't have been on that website server. Took it off. And then we made a decision to work with a company called All Clear. And so what All Clear will do is they will provide credit repair for anybody whose credit's impacted in this first year. So we tried to notify as many people as we could via letter, and we had notified employers and so forth to make sure that the word was out there. But so we actually probably went above and beyond what we had to do, because we don't think anything was taken off that server, but just to be on the safe side, we went through those other steps to make sure that if anybody's information was taken and their credit is damaged, that they would have credit repair.
Representative Kaiser.
Madam Chair and Brian, on that service that you've contracted for, how do they determine if I've had damage to my credit, that it's due to them versus someone else? Are they going to cover it regardless of the source?
Madam Chair, Representative Kaiser, that was something we're working on. But basically, if you call if you call down to this company and say, my credit's been damaged, there are probably a good chance they will cover us. If somebody calls in and says, my credit was damaged, I received a letter, I was notified from WSI or the employer that my information had taken off, they will provide credit repair for that person. And it's a little bit, it worked out a little bit different than I thought it would, but that's how the system works. You know, I thought we'd give them a list of all the names and they would go through the names, but that really hasn't been how it worked.
Representative Kaiser.
Speaking from experience, I've had bad luck with credit cards lately, and they've been compromised twice in the last few months. So, sort of like a pre-existing condition, a month from now, I find that my credit has an issue, that they're not going to look to see whether or not I've had a compromised credit card and other possibilities. They'll just accept the liability.
That's the way I understand the contract as is.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. We'll move on then to our claim review process. Jennifer had mentioned at the beginning that she would go through that toward the end when we wanted to discuss our plan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So as I've been listening to this committee today, I've been pondering something that Representative Kaiser talked about earlier in the talking about if in your review process you want to take some steps to keep your injured workers' information more confidential. As I think about that, it might require a change in the law. We've got open meeting requirements, and we lay out the parameters about when we can go into an executive session. I don't think that's clearly laid out in our creating law to allow us to do that. So I'm leaning towards, if you want to do that, it's probably something for a future interim, not this one. But I certainly wouldn't cut off the idea that there are things you could do to tighten up. Okay, so here I am on page 2 on that background memo. And I want to direct you to Appendix E. It's the very last appendix on this background memo. What that Appendix E is the application package that we've used during the most recent interim. So obviously, you know, the chairman's name is wrong and the dates are wrong, but the substance is something that we've used over and over again since our initial interim when we created it. We've tweaked it a little bit, but it's essentially what we've used. That application packet, before I go into the what's in it, talk a little bit about who can get their hands on it. What we have done is we've put it on the Legislative Council website, so that's a link. I think historically WSI has copied over to that link, so their site, you can also reach it there. We've sent out, you guys are legislators, if you've read your mail, you realize that traditionally we'll send out a letter to every one of our legislators saying, remember, you've got this committee, and you know, and here's the link to the packet. You can, if you've got a constituent who contacts you with a concern about their workers' comp coverage, keep in mind you can refer them to participate in this committee's activities. So, you know, kind of that discussion of how do you get the word out there. We've also oftentimes sent a letter with a link over to the State Bar Association as they receive calls from members of the public regularly asking for information about how can I get an attorney or I'm not happy about this thing that happened. So food for thought as we go through this. Think about, we've got this information packet. How do you want to inform people about it so that they'll access it? You know, it'll be sitting on our website. It'll be there. How do we want to let them know it's there? Okay, so what this packet usually has 4 documents in it. We've got that cover letter explaining the process and the eligibility requirements. We've got a copy of the statute that creates the committee, which we've gone through already. We've got that release of information and authorization form. That's the one that's required. You know, we talked about the statute says there are certain things you need to do to get in front of the committee. One of them is complete that release form. And then we've got an optional form, and that's the review issue summary form. And you'll see that in our document. We can walk through those.
I'll give you a second if you want to quickly look through that cover letter. After the conversations we've had today, it should make sense. It should be pretty clear. As you're perusing it, one thing I want to bring to your attention is at the bottom in big bold capital letters. Over the years, we've tried to clear up this language to make it really clear that if you pursue this this avenue, you need to be clear that we're not an appeals tribunal. You can't appeal what we do. It's not changing the outcome of your case. It's designed to change the law relating to workers' comp. So we try to really make it clear to our applicants that don't confuse this with an appeal process. The second document we have, if you go by that cover letter, it's that authorization form. And there's a date on there. If we use the same form, we'll obviously update the interim we're referring to and the date. This was created working with WSI to make sure that it met their requirements, as it's, you know, it's authorization to them to release information to us. And then that, what I had kind of portrayed as an optional letter, is that review issue summary. Our statute that creates this doesn't say you have to summarize your issues and submit it. It's just really helpful if you do. So we give this here to give somebody an opportunity to start laying out, here's this thing that happened that I wasn't happy with. You know, I was denied, or as an IME, or I was a volunteer firefighter, and I don't have covered employment, so I don't have wage loss. You know, whatever it is, kind of narrow down on that. Before we started the interim, I'd asked WSI, you know, look over these. Is there something you want? Is there a change? And I think they said essentially the forms are working, and if I'm misspeaking, they know how to correct me. However, one of the representatives from WSI had mentioned, you know, on that very last form on that review issue summary, if you look at that part three, there's a 1, 2, 3. Under number one, there's a suggestion that maybe we encourage them to put more detail there. And it says, as part of this presentation, we suggest you include the workers' compensation issue or WSI decision with which you disagree. Maybe some more details about, you know, is there a date? Is there a specific order? I mean, you don't want to put hurdles in front of them, I assume, that intimidate them in filling it out, because they may not have the date. But anyway, that was a suggestion from WSI that maybe we could ask for a little more detail in that clause right there. So that's what your packet looks like. Do you want me to pause there? Do you want me to just go on with the process that you've...
Does anybody have questions for Jennifer before she goes on?
Okay. And I know for a lot of you guys, you've lived this process, you know. But let's go over it again. Some people haven't, and maybe there's some ways we could improve what we've done in the past. So what we do is, the first thing I go over is, how do you get the ball moving? How do you get before this committee? So we've got an application packet. They may phone us up and ask for it, or they may get online and just get it off the our website. And they mail that in to us. When I get that and I look at it and I make sure it's complete, specifically, do I have that authorization to release? Did they give me a claim number? Or do I have a way to identify they had a contact with WSI? I will make a copy of that and I will send it over to a liaison over at WSI, and that's traditionally been Chuck Coker, who's here today, just to follow what we're doing, and I understand that he will continue to fill that role. So I email that over to him, and I say, Chuck, does it look like this applicant has met those qualifying factors? Did they have a touch with you? Do they have any active appeals? Has their time for appeal passed? Do you think they've met those? Because they're the keeper of that information. Chuck will get back to me, and usually the answer is yes. Usually they typically have, they meet those requirements. And when I get his response, I will then get back to the chairman and say, well, we've had this applicant, and Chuck says they likely qualify, or Chuck's concerned perhaps they don't qualify. I'll visit with you a bit and say, you know, what's your spin? Here's how I see it. And we'll make a determination.
And if the determination is, no, they don't meet whatever qualifying factor it is, we'll send them out a notification and say, the following isn't met. And sometimes it's your time for appeal hasn't passed yet, so it's just sit tight. Wait, you know, if you're not going to appeal on this, wait 60 more days and you'll be good. Or we'll send them out an approval letter saying, yes, you meet our qualifying factors. We'll have, you know, we'll get in touch with you and somebody from WSI will get in touch with you and they'll help you summarize your case, go over your kind of the factual elements of your case and find out what your concerns are as far as what do you think should have been done differently. And Chuck's filled that role really well. He's taken a lot of time when those individuals are identified. If it's possible, if he's able to travel to where that injured employee is, he usually will go and meet with them in person if he can. Sometimes, you know, they're out of state or it's not possible to get to them. And I, you know, don't know what your directives are this time, but he's really gone out of his way to spend a chunk of time with that individual to go through their claim. So he will do that. After he has gone through that process, he'll contact me and say, Jen, I've got a rough draft, you know, a pretty final draft of a summary of their claim saying, here's who our injured worker is, here's when they were injured, here's what we did, here are the orders that we issued. And usually through that summary he puts together, it'll become clear what the issue is they're raising. He'll focus on that. Chuck and I will sit down and we'll go through that and make sure that I can wrap my head around it. He'll finalize it and then I will let you know that this is in the works. We'll set up a meeting date. We'll make sure that it works for WSI. It makes sure it works for the injured worker. And I usually at that time will send off an email to another individual at WSI, not the one who's designed to be that liaison, but the one who's representing workers' comp and assistance. And that's traditionally been Tim Wallin, and I think you've been identified as doing that again. So I will contact Tim Wallin real quickly and just say, email, here's our injured worker. If it's clear to me what the issues are, you know, maybe it has to do with IME, or you know, just a real quick bullet. I try to be careful not to be put in a position where an injured worker may feel like I'm tipping their hand or giving too much information so that WSI comes in with guns a-blazing. It also doesn't help WSI at all if they don't have a heads up about what the issue is, because they need to do their preparation as well. So I will try to walk that line pretty carefully. So then we come to this meeting, and we're typically in this room, and we can put the injured worker and Chuck right down here in the middle, and if they've got their representative who's going to help walk them through it, they'll sit down here and present their case. Chuck will say, well, here's this binder of material I put together, and he'll walk through it, and it's pretty informal. At the end of that, then what we've kind of evolved into is Chuck will then turn over to the injured worker and say, you know, now it's your opportunity to say what are the issues you want to bring to the committee. He's stepped back from that a little bit, and that seems to work well. The injured worker will then have an opportunity to say, well, you know, now that you know what happened, here's what I don't think happened correctly or I wish happened differently. And at the end of that discussion, typically, Tim Wallin will be invited up to say, stand at the lectern and give his perspective of that the issue that's raised or why that occurred or why it didn't occur the way the person said it occurred. You know, he'll give that WSI piece. And remember, they've signed that authorization to release, and that's what opens the door and allows Tim to stand up and do that. Otherwise, you know, before this committee, we had the he said, she said, and the she said from WSI was really quiet because he wasn't in a position to talk about it. He's been given that authorization to release, and it's positive that he has an opportunity to discuss it and talk about the details. Traditionally, that's how it's taken place. Another thing that we try to put on the agenda is an opportunity for members of the public, interested persons, any member of the public who wants to talk about the issues raised. The chairman's traditionally been really clear to say, this isn't your opportunity to talk about your situation if you happen to be an injured worker. You know, if you want to have the opportunity this injured worker has to come before the committee, you have to jump through all the hoops, fill out the forms, go through the whole process just like they did. But we've, you know, we've had individuals come up and testify, and they do have something meaningful to add to the process. Or, I'm familiar with that happening, and one of the concerns is X, Y, or Z. So we have that discussion. And that usually takes half of a meeting. That's either a morning or an afternoon. I know when we had higher numbers, I remember there was one meeting I think we went to where we had an evening session. Just because that's how we traveled, and I think that's when our injured worker could get there. So we've, you know, that usually takes 2.5, 3 hours just to do that piece. We've informed the injured worker that, so this is your opportunity to come here and sit at the table and have this discussion. Be aware that this committee, it's quite likely that they will continue to talk about the issues you raised. You know, you may hear that, and then there may be an additional request from WSI to say, can you tell me the history on volunteer firefighters, or, you know, tell me the history of that law, or, you know, whatever it is. So it's oftentimes discussed at more than just that introductory meeting. So in theory, what I just said should reflect what this background memorandum says. So, you know, that's what we've done in the past. There's been another actor from WSI. It's been Patsy Pearl, who will come to all of these meetings and kind of sit in the back, and you won't know she's there. But she will be online, and she'll have access to the electronic records at WSI. So Chuck will show up, and we'll have this binder with the material he's put together in it. And it's really helpful, and he tabs it all so you can see all his documents. But obviously, the workers' comp record is significantly larger than the information that Chuck's narrowed it down to here. Patsy's present at these meetings, and if something comes up and they say, oh, well, show me the pharmaceuticals that they used, or that doesn't seem consistent, or we wish we had that, she's got it printed here, she'll spit them out, and has access to that, so she can give us some guidance on that. So as I hold up this binder, I think I mentioned a little bit, we call this is WSI's, when they come out, this will be WSI's binder. The material they put in there is WSI's. I happen to have it in my hands just for the purpose of the meeting. We'll give it back to WSI, and they can archive it however they want. Because it's WSI's, we don't let you guys leave the room with it. As we come in and prepare for a meeting, I'll send out a reminder notice saying, you know, we've got this meeting, let's say it starts at 9. I'll be down here at 7:30 or 8 o'clock, and I'll have your folders here. So if you want to read through it ahead of time to prepare yourself so you're not coming in cold, you can certainly do that. Just don't leave the room with this. We'll round them up again. We also give that same binder to Tim Wally, and I think Patsy gets one too, just so she knows what you guys are looking at. But those are the actors. That's traditionally what we've done. Does that seem consistent with those members that have been on here before? Does that kind of play out how we've done it, or how you thought we did?
Sounds like a system that works, unless other committee members have recognition of times when it did not. I certainly would appreciate following the same procedure, not only to keep it consistent for members here, but also for workers' compensation and workers out there, so that we don't keep moving the target or changing the hoops that they need to jump through to come before the committee. Consistency is good. Senator Summer?
The only question I have is, you know, I looked at the history of the claims reviewed, and it was maybe four or five sessions ago, they reviewed a lot of claims, it seemed like, took a lot of time, a lot of meetings. How did that process work? And I noticed last time when I was on the committee, last time around, there was only one. It was quite simple. And at what point, I mean, maybe it's already set up, the link on the website, so that you can tie into some of this report you want to talk about it? Because I looked on WSI's homepage, I couldn't see anything on there. And maybe it's not there yet. Maybe it's going to be.
Representative Kaiser?
Madam Chair and committee members, as I was listening to the process, I agree. And I think there are some more concerns out there. And the legislation that this committee has generally sent to the legislature has been passed and has improved our delivery of workers' comp to injured workers. So it's important for us to hear from those folks. Because of our constraint that if it's involved in any legal or decision-making process, we can't review it. And this may be opening box we don't want to open, but the decision review office, Chuck's office, one of the advantages of a claimant going through there is they also gain access to the $500 for attorneys. Or one of the other benefits might be that we take a period of time, 2, 3, 5 years, the last 5 years, and send this letter to people who had positive and negative decisions, saying, if you think there's an issue in the law that should be addressed, because we're making our decisions based on the law, you should come, because that's the audience out there. Legislators, you may have somebody who talks to you about a complaint, but it's more likely you don't. And the attorneys, well, if they're handling these cases, they're currently engaged in litigation. They may not go back to think about what happened 5 years ago and track someone down, but the actual claimants that have gone through the DRO process may have a different perspective on our law, and maybe we should ask those folks.
Good point. Representative Verby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another thing, I think one of the reasons some of them they've kind of went down is initially there were a lot of claims that were trying to address some of the cracks in the changes of laws that, you know, where they weren't retroactive, and so their perspective, and there were some benefits that just kind of fell in a crack. And so I think some of those were addressed, as well as some additional. I would like to recognize Jennifer Clark's work in this committee. I remember one year that I chaired this, we had somebody who couldn't speak a bit of English, and we had to get an interpreter. And it was on a speakerphone, because they weren't here in the state. And so that, I think they were in South Dakota, is that right? It was, and that was extremely difficult to, you know, take the time to wait for the interpretation on everything through a conference call. So I mean, I think it's been a good committee that has served its purpose and not done with its job, but I think it's done a good job to address the issues that it was intended for. I do have a question for Mr. Klipfula, if he would. The 1 year that I was in this committee, or on this committee, there was an issue, and we were just talking about the application and the forms, and whether or not, you know, it was easily understood by the injured worker. There was also that year, there was a lot of the claims confusion was based on, they didn't understand exactly what they were supposed to do, how they were supposed to respond, and Jennifer put some of the language of one of the forms into a program, and it determined it was like a second or third year college reading level. And we didn't enact any legislation to address that issue, but it was sort of a direction and a process that WSI would work on that and continually address that issue and try to simplify it and make it more direct and understood by people of different reading abilities and comprehension. Can you give me any information on how that's either been progressing or if you believe that was completed successfully?
Madam Chair, Representative Ruby, yes, we have been working on that. I mean, that was actually kind of even an eye-opener for me to see some of that. And, you know, a lot of the information that we provided was difficult to understand. But we have worked on that. We have a forms committee that deals with forms at WSI, and those are some of the things that we definitely look at as far as are they easily understood. So to answer your question, yes, we have been doing that, and we are very, very cognizant of that, and especially since that one claimant.
Other questions or comments? I certainly thank the reduction in claims coming before this committee or injured workers coming before this committee is a testament to the work being done at WSI to improve the appeals process and the work that former committee members here have done to change laws and fix those cracks. So I think it's wonderful to see a reduction in those those people feeling that they need to come before us to change laws. Any other comments or questions? Well, can I assume that the committee believes that we are following a good process and we can continue to follow that process going forward? Do I move to entertain a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move that we continue the process with the one caveat that we add sending this letter out to claimants that have come through the DRO process for the last 3 years.
Moved by Kaiser. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved by Representative Kaiser, seconded by Representative Ruby to continue to follow our process as we have in the past, with the addition of sending the informative letter to former claimants over the past 5 years. Over the past 3 years, so that we are reaching people who may have a story to tell. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote.
Senators Pullman?
Yes.
Hilzer?
Aye.
Sinner?
Aye.
Representatives Kaiser?
Yes.
Emmerman?
Yes.
And Ruby?
Yes.
The motion does pass.
That takes care of our agenda. Are there any committee directives for future meetings? I know that I would really like to see Representative Kaiser give a presentation on trends that he has seen, not just here in North Dakota, but nationwide, and making some comparisons to what we see here versus other states, if that's something he's willing to do. Are there other discussion points or topics that people have an interest in hearing from for our next meeting? Okay, well, we look forward to hearing about the alcohol server program and the continued work with the pilot program, if that's okay. Great, meeting adjourned.